Lecture 10, The History of American Language Policy.
What's the official language of the United States? English, right? Actually, wrong. The U.S. has never had an official language, and it doesn't have one today. But maybe it's time we change that. It seems like we've never had so many non-English-speaking immigrants in the U.S. Don't we have to do something to protect the English language in America? And what about bilingual education? Shouldn't we be teaching English in our schools, not Spanish? Is it really a good idea to have bilingual street signs, shop signs, and voting ballots? If we don't do something soon, American English will be an endangered language, won't it? Let's step back and think about it. Let's set aside our fears and put things in historical perspective. America has always been a nation of immigrants. English itself is an immigrant language. There were hundreds of indigenous American languages in what would later become the United States, and they were there for centuries before the first English speakers arrived in the late 1500s. And English wasn't the first European language in what is now the United States. Spanish predates English by far. Spanish explorers first arrived in what is now Florida in 1513. They established their first permanent colony, San Agustin, in 1565. The Spanish also moved into the West and Southwest quite early on. Santa Fe became a capital city in 1610, making it one of the oldest in today's United States. Other Spanish settlements were established soon afterwards in New Mexico, Colorado, Arizona, and western Texas. The Spanish began founding missions in California in the mid-1700s, a century before English speakers arrived there in significant numbers. They also held the Louisiana Territory from 1763 to 1800. In fact, when Americans won their independence from England in 1783, Spain still laid claim to about half the territory of today's continental United States. French was also prominent in the colonial era, especially in the Louisiana Territory. Napoleon reclaimed the territory for France in 1800 and then sold it to the U.S. in 1803. And Dutch was the main language of New Amsterdam. When it passed into English hands in 1664 and became New York, it was already home to 18 non-indigenous languages. And finally, there was German. Germans and their descendants have long been one of the biggest population groups in the colonies and in the U.S. At the time of the first U.S. census in 1790, 8.7% of the population of the new nation was German, and their numbers kept increasing. There were important pockets of German settlements in the mid-Atlantic, especially Pennsylvania, and many official documents and a number of newspapers were published in German. In fact, German was the official language of what was once the colony of New Sweden in present-day Delaware, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. German influence would later extend throughout the U.S., especially to Midwestern states like Wisconsin, Illinois, Minnesota, Ohio, and Missouri. For the most part, the plurality of languages in the early U.S. was tolerated. John Adams, the nation's second president, called for the establishment of an American Academy for refining, improving, and ascertaining the English language. But for the most part, legislators didn't listen, and no language academy was established. Ben Franklin was worried about what he perceived to be the threat of Germans in Pennsylvania. He wrote, "Why should Pennsylvania, founded by the English, become a colony of aliens, who will shortly be so numerous as to Germanize us instead of our Anglifying them, and will never adopt our language or customs, any more than they can acquire our complexion?" Sound familiar? Substitute, say, California or Arizona for Pennsylvania, and Spanishize for Germanize, and it sounds like something you'd hear today, maybe from leaders of a group like U.S. English or English First, dedicated to making English the official language of the United States, or from legislators in California and Arizona, who in fact did make English the official language of their respective states, and not all that long ago, in 1986 and 2006. But America's founders didn't establish an official language, and it didn't seem to matter. English became the de facto language of the new nation, and allowances were made for other languages where necessary. Thomas Jefferson appointed a territorial governor in French-speaking Louisiana who didn't even speak any French. But that didn't work. Most residents of the territory couldn't understand their new leader, and so Jefferson soon acknowledged the linguistic realities of the new territory and mandated that its official records be kept in both French and English. For most of the 19th century, the Louisiana legislature and courts operated bilingually. Spanish was also taken into account when necessary. California's 1849 Constitution mandated that all statutes be translated into Spanish. Reflecting the influx of new immigrant groups in the 1800s, states such as Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Missouri translated laws and governors' messages into German and sometimes Norwegian and even Welsh. In 1857, the Minnesota State Constitution was printed in English, German, Swedish, Norwegian, and French. And the Texas Constitution, adopted in the mid-1870s, was printed in English, German, Spanish, and Czech. Educational policies were also favorable to immigrant languages throughout much of the 1800s. Bilingual education in French and English was supported by linguistic legislation in Louisiana, and there was bilingual schooling in German and English throughout the country. In fact, a greater percentage of school children received at least part of their instruction in German in 1900 than are enrolled in bilingual programs in America today. So at first, and continuing throughout most of the 1800s, there was general acceptance of languages other than English in the U.S. And this didn't hurt English one bit. The English language spread throughout the U.S. as the country expanded westward. A number of other European languages came in too, but they weren't really seen as a threat, at least not at first. One notable exception to the general air of linguistic tolerance was indigenous American languages. As Americans moved westward, Native American peoples and Native American languages suffered devastating casualties. Europeans had been at war with Native Americans since the earliest exploratory and colonial days. When America gained independence and began pushing westward, they forced Native Americans westward too. Andrew Jackson's Indian Removal Act of 1830 uprooted tens of thousands of Native Americans from their homes across a vast area in the southeastern U.S. The displacement affected a number of tribes, for example, the Choctaw, Seminole, Creek, and Cherokee. And the displaced peoples were forced to walk over 1,000 miles westward to the Oklahoma Territory. Thousands died along the Trail of Tears of exposure, disease, hunger, and exhaustion. And the displacement, violence, and death continued as whites moved ever westward. The Indian Wars of the 19th century culminated in the notorious Wounded Knee Massacre of 1890 at the Lakota Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. In a single day, U.S. soldiers killed more than 200 and maybe as many as 300 men, women, and children of the Sioux tribe. As European occupation and expansion spread throughout the Americas, the continent's indigenous languages and cultures were decimated. Hundreds of Native American languages were killed, and not just individual languages, but entire language families. Just think about it. It's like losing the range of languages that makes up the Indo-European language family, which includes languages ranging from English and German to Irish and Scots Gaelic to Spanish and French to Hindi and Bengali. Or the Sino-Tibetan language family, which encompasses hundreds of East Asian, Southeast Asian, and South Asian languages. Imagine today's world without Mandarin, Spanish, English, or Hindi. It seems impossible. These languages top the list of languages with the most native speakers. But we'll never have more than a faint whisper of what the indigenous Native American language families used to be. Most of them have long been lost to us. Today, fewer than 200 Native American languages are spoken in North America. Of these, most are endangered, spoken by only a handful of older people. Fewer than 35 are actively spoken by both adults and children. So, there's more than one language map we could picture for America. We could envision a map of current American English dialects. We'd see big dialect areas like the North, South, Midland, and West. And we'd see lots of linguistic detail in the East, including city dialects like New York, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Charleston, and New Orleans. And we'd see sub-regional dialects like the Appalachian South and the Texas South. Or we could picture a map of Native American languages. Instead of a richly varied and intricately detailed picture, we'd see a lot of blank spaces. especially east of the Mississippi, where Native Americans assimilated to European languages over the centuries or were forced out. As if this weren't enough, there were also deliberate policies aimed at linguistic eradication. In ironic recognition of the importance of language to cultural identity, the U.S. government made quite purposeful efforts to stamp out Indian languages as a means of stamping out Indian tribal identities. J.D.C. Atkins, Commissioner of Indian Affairs in 1887, expressed this sentiment overtly. He said, quote, "Teaching an Indian youth in his own barbarous dialect is a positive detriment to him. The first step to be taken toward civilization, toward teaching the Indians the mischief and folly of continuing in their barbarous practices, is to teach them the English language," end quote. And these beliefs were put into cruel and deliberate action. A number of Indian boarding schools were established throughout the U.S., beginning in 1879. Indian children were taken from their homelands and tribes and brought to centralized schools, put together with children from other tribes with different customs and different languages. They were taught American ways, and they were taught in English. They were forbidden to speak their native languages. In fact, they were shamed, and they were punished for doing so. The schools had an express purpose, summarized by a congressional subcommittee on Indian education. And the committee says, "They were designated to separate a child from his reservation and family, strip him of his tribal lore and mores, force the complete abandonment of his native language, and prepare him for never again returning to his people." Now, this committee was convened nearly a century after the boarding schools were first implemented, and it was still contending with the disastrous effects of the earlier educational policies against Native American languages and peoples. As policies against indigenous languages were implemented in the late 1800s, tolerance began to wane for other non-English languages in the U.S. too. School instruction in immigrant languages began to be curtailed or even outlawed. Anti-Catholic sentiment led to the suppression of German, even though many German speakers weren't even Catholic. And then World War I came along and really pushed German out of America's schools and American public life. Another key factor in the so-called Americanization campaign of the late 19th and early 20th centuries is the sheer number of speakers of languages other than English. Immigration from Europe reached its first peak in the decades between 1890 and 1919. And many of these were so-called new immigrants, Italians, Jews, Greeks, and Slavs, not the Germans, Irish, and Scandinavians that Americans were already used to. And these new immigrants were accused, even by a federal commission, of not learning English as quickly as the old immigrants. Sound familiar? At the risk of repeating myself, just substitute Latin Americans and Asians for new immigrants and Europeans for old immigrants, and there you go. The same sentiments repeated again 100-plus years later. There was a backlash against the influx of immigration. A quota system was enacted in 1924, and it would remain in place until 1965. Under this system, immigration was limited to 2% of each immigrant group already in the country as of the 1890 national census. The numbers went down, and so did the diversity of America's immigrant groups. Never mind the welcoming sentiments of the Statue of Liberty, "Give me your tired, you're poor." America closed its doors in the early 20th century, or at least left them open only a crack. Also in the late 1800s and early 1900s, the first laws requiring literacy for immigration, citizenship, and voting were passed. And the voting laws affected not only new immigrants, but people who had been in the U.S. a long time, the descendants of slaves of African descent in the U.S. South. And finally, after decades of accommodation to continental European languages, cries for official English began to be heard at the government level. The state of Nebraska declared English its official language in 1920. Just after this, in 1923, the first federal attempt at language legislation was introduced. This was a bill to declare American the official language. This was a somewhat jocular anti-British statement, not necessarily an anti-immigrant one. Note that the proposed language was American, not English per se. But still, the sentiments behind it were pro-English. The state of Illinois actually did adopt American as its official language. It wasn't changed to English until 1969. So, you're probably seeing a theme here. Language policies aren't made in a socio-political vacuum, and policies against certain languages are almost always policies against certain peoples. Sometimes overtly, as in the case of anti-Native American language policies, and sometimes covertly, as in the case of the literacy tests for voting, a thinly disguised effort to disenfranchise African Americans in the U.S. South. Our judgments of the value and rightful place of various languages and dialects are grounded in our judgments of the people who use them. Remember, linguistically, there's nothing inherently better or worse about one dialect of English versus another. And there's nothing inherently superior about any one language. Why would German be the official language of Germany, or Spanish one of the official languages of Spain? Both of these are perfectly good languages, but they have at times been unpopular in America, Spanish nowadays, and German in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Anti-immigration sentiment in the U.S. ran high during the first half of the 20th century in the wake of two world wars. English speakers became fearful, not only of German, but also the East Asian languages that were becoming more and more prevalent on the U.S. West Coast. So America became increasingly English-speaking in the 20th century, at least on the surface, in public spaces, in the classroom, the workplace, the courtroom, and the government. James Crawford is a longtime advocate of language rights and president of the Institute for Language and Education Policy. He calls the mid-20th century the least diverse period, linguistically speaking, in America's history. Immigrant numbers were at an all-time low. The percentage of foreign-born residents in the U.S. went from 14.7% in 1910 to 4.7% in 1970. But still, there was no official English at the federal level. English had a stronghold anyway, without any specific legislation to promote it. In fact, despite all the anti-immigrant sentiment, there were several important pieces of legislation actually designed to protect other languages in the U.S. One of the most important rulings on language rights in U.S. history was handed down in 1923 in Meyer versus Nebraska. In this case, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the state's prohibition against teaching non-English languages, in this case German, in its schools was unconstitutional. The due process and equal protections afforded by the 14th Amendment forbade it. Here's what the court had to say. Quote, "The individual has certain fundamental rights which must be respected. The protection of the Constitution extends to all, to those who speak other languages, as well as to those born with English on the tongue. Perhaps it would be highly advantageous if all had ready understanding of our ordinary speech, but this cannot be coerced with methods which conflict with the Constitution. A desirable end cannot be promoted by prohibited means," end quote. The next important piece of legislation for American linguistic diversity was the Civil Rights Act of 1964. This included Title VI, a law that prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, and national origin in programs and activities receiving federal financial assistance, which would include, of course, federally funded schools. The act was tested in another landmark case, Lau versus Nichols, in 1974. This time, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that providing English-only instruction to non-English-speaking public school students in San Francisco was a violation of Title VI. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act affirms linguistic rights in the workplace. It mandates that employers cannot discriminate on the basis of race or national origin, and this includes discrimination on the basis of language of national origin. Around the same time the Civil Rights Act was passed, the quota system for American immigration was lifted. Now immigrants could come in on the basis of family unity and based on job skills. And so the doors were opened up once again, and the U.S. began a new period of linguistic and cultural diversification. The U.S. Census Bureau reports that 75% of America's foreign-born population came from Europe in 1960, just prior to the lifting of the quota system. In 2010, only 12% of foreign-born were from Europe. 53% now came from Latin America, and 28% came from Asia. As diversity increased, so did the numbers. In 1970, only 4.7% of the U.S. population were foreign-born. This figure increased steadily over the next several decades, from 6.2% in 1980 to 7.9% in 1990 to 11.1% in the year 2000. In 2010, when the latest census was taken, 12.9% of Americans reported being foreign-born. As immigrants came in, linguistic tolerance went down. The 1980s saw a huge upsurge in the number of U.S. states declaring English as their official language. Today, there are 31. A couple of these states also recognize the language rights of others. In Hawaii, the Hawaiian language is co-official with English. And in Oklahoma, the Cherokee language is official within the Cherokee Nation, where the Trail of Tears ended for so many displaced Native Americans in the 1800s. The 1980s also saw the first serious attempts to make English the official language at the federal level. In 1981, California Republican Senator S.I. Hayakawa, founder of the U.S. English Movement, introduced a constitutional amendment that would prohibit making any federal law requiring the use of any language other than English. Congress never voted on this, but legislative efforts to make English the official language of the U.S. continued throughout the 80s and 90s and into the 21st century. The proposals tend to be attached to immigration reform bills, so that makes things complicated, as you can imagine. And as I noted earlier, it's no coincidence that concerns about too much non-English in America go hand in hand with concerns about immigration. Now, we can imagine other reasons why a country might want to promote a single language. Ideally, as a single nation, we should all be able to communicate with each other, and ideally, we shouldn't have to have information translated into hundreds of different languages in order to do this, right? Since well before Ben Franklin's day, countries have argued that having a single national language promotes national unity. That's at least partly why there's an Italian language academy, the Accademia della Crusca, established way back in 1583, and a French academy, the Académie Française, established in 1635. And sometimes this argument seems right. Think about all the language-related problems Canada has had. Couldn't these have been prevented if there were only one official language, not both French and English? Well, actually, a big part of the problem in Canada is that the linguistic rights of its very large French-speaking population were denied for so long. This led to backlash and to continuing separatist sentiments in the province of Quebec, beginning in the 1970s. Things might not have gotten to this pass if linguistic rights had been more respected from the outset, if there actually had been a more laissez-faire attitude toward language policies and official languages in Canada. Consider the findings of linguist Joshua Fishman, a prominent scholar on language policy, language maintenance and loss, and multilingualism. In a study of 130 nation states, he found no correlation between linguistic diversity and civil strife. James Crawford sums up the situation well. Commenting on Fishman's findings, he writes, quote, "For every Canada, where language differences have become politicized, there is a Switzerland, where four language groups have coexisted harmoniously for centuries, enjoying equal rights under their constitution," end quote. So it doesn't sound like a unitary language is strictly necessary to promote national unity in the U.S. or anywhere else. We also have to bear in mind that even when countries do have official languages, they're never really monolingual. The vast majority of the world's population speaks more than one language, and linguistically homogeneous nations are very much the exception, not the rule. We humans care deeply about our languages. This goes to the heart of why communities and nations often feel the need to enact laws and policies to protect them. Languages play a key role in people's sense of group and personal identity. To lose a language can feel like losing a part of yourself. Language endangerment can feel real to people who sense they're being overwhelmed by speakers of other languages. And, all too often, language loss is real. There are more than 6,000 different languages in the world today, maybe close to 7,000. But linguists estimate that half or more of these will be extinct by the end of the 21st century. There's a genuine epidemic. Languages are dying at an alarming rate. But English isn't one of them. English has long been the dominant language in America, and it continues to maintain its top position today. Studies and census figures show that most immigrant families tend to switch to English within 2 to 3 generations of arrival. English is also, of course, a major world language. We've never needed any laws to protect English in America or anywhere else, and we don't need any today. If anything, we need to protect non-English languages. If we agree that all languages have value and that preserving the world's linguistic diversity is important. There's a personal cost to language loss, but there are also grave consequences for our scientific understanding of ourselves and our world. And quite frankly, there are consequences for the continued survival of human culture. Languages are a window into the human mind. The less linguistic diversity we have, the less we can achieve a full understanding of the nature of human cognition. Languages also embody cultural history. Linguistic diversity embodies the myriad ways human cultures have devised over millennia for making sense of the natural environment and for interacting sustainably with it. The English language encodes certain ways of looking at the world, of organizing our relations to people, objects, events, and ecosystems. Other languages embody quite different ways of thinking. Linguist Marion Methune specializes in the study of Native American languages. She's documented some grammatical features of Mohawk, a Northeastern Native American language, that are very different from those of English. For example, there are different markers for different types of possession. In English, we say things like my hat, my arm, and my grandfather. So one grammatical marker, my. But these are three very different types of possession. I can own a hat one day, but give it away or lose it the next. But I could only lose my arm under quite difficult circumstances. And my grandfather will always be my grandfather, even though he's no longer alive. We have to stop and think about these differences in English, but not so in Mohawk. They're embedded in the grammar, so they're more prominent in people's minds. Mohawk also has markers to indicate how information is known, markers of evidentiality. Sort of like English phrases like, I heard, I saw, someone told me, but more embedded in the grammar, so that you can't actually convey the information without also conveying just how you know it. Languages embody ways of ordering, thinking about, and picturing the natural world. The Mohawk word for lightning has to be translated in English as a whole sentence. It's sticking its tongue out here and there. And that's certainly a different way of looking at lightning than, say, Ben Franklin's view. Throughout this course, I've been stressing that all languages and dialects are linguistically equal. Methune reminds us that, yes, they are, in that they're all equally worthwhile. But at the same time, no, they're not equal. They're not interchangeable. Each language is special. And something unique is lost each time a language is lost. But all is not lost for Native American languages in the U.S. Today in California, there are 18 language families and 74 languages spoken, though mostly they're spoken by very small numbers of speakers. The largest indigenous language left in the U.S. is Navajo, with about 200,000 speakers. And efforts at revitalization are alive and well in many Native communities, where tribal members work with linguists like Methune to document, teach, and preserve Native ways of speaking. Native American languages are resilient, as are Native American peoples. Remember the story of the Lumbee Indians of southeastern North Carolina. They've been speaking English since at least the early 1700s, but despite suffering the loss of their native language, they've innovated a new dialect of English that effectively expresses their unique identity and cultural heritage. Native American languages and cultures have survived in the U.S. despite being overwhelmed by English, and despite harsh policies against them and violent actions against their speakers. American English will certainly survive in its far more favorable climate. We don't have to fear linguistic diversity. In fact, we should protect and promote it. That's the best way to ensure that America will continue to thrive in our complex world with its myriad peoples.